Hello, we're here. Look at this.
Wow.
It's John Pollock and Eric Marcotte live from the post office. Eric Marcotte exists in the flesh, no less. And here we are. This is a John Pollock production here. So please, I will be monitoring the comments to make sure our audio's going out, the video's going out. I've had to change around the post office here. But Eric, you have made it here in town. It's not every day that you come down to Toronto, it but isn't. I know what you said. You're like, we cannot review Khalil Roundtree Jr. going for the championship on a StreamYard. We have to do this one in person. So you have come all the way down to the 416.
This was way too big to be doing via split screen. Okay, I'm here. I'm wearing my tourist trap outfit and enjoying the MMA.
Well, we are here to talk about UFC 307. Tell us first about the actual reason you were down here, because you were at quite the game on Saturday. Tell us a little bit about this trip for you.
Yeah, I came down to watch the Toronto FC Inter Miami game. It only cost me a month's pay, but it was quite the experience. Okay, I've never been to BMO Field or anything before, so it was nice to go down there, get to see that part of the city, and enjoy the game with some absolute lunatics.
Yeah, so Messi was playing. This was like a big deal in Toronto. How many altercations did you observe at this game?
Oh man, there was, so the guy sitting next to me, I told John before we went on, there was a guy sitting next to me who's a Toronto FC diehard. Like, this is a guy who's clearly gone to every game they've probably had for the last decade. And he was so angry that everybody, he was here to see Lionel Messi. And keep in mind, this guy had, I think, six $29 martinis before the game even started. So he was a bit up there, and he was ready to fight anybody in our section who was wearing a Lionel Messi jersey, which was a sizable amount of people, until security came and started to get them to cover up the shirts, handing out these like white plain t-shirts of shame for everybody, and they were ejecting people. There was five pitch invaders, which was remarkable. I think I would have thought they would have tightened security up a bit when you have maybe the biggest celebrity on the entire planet playing, but no.
Just good old BMO Field security. How did you enjoy? Have you ever been to BMO before?
No, this was the first time.
And what was your impressions of the experience?
Pretty good, honestly. It was like, I was dreading getting in there, but it was a pretty quick entry. Seats were decent. I mean, I was happy with it.
I've been to a few TFC games. I've always had a good time going there. I'm not a soccer follower in the least, but I thought it serves its purpose.
Yeah.
You know, that's all I look for in venues. They serve their purpose.
We don't have venues like that out in Sudbury. Okay, we have...
Matt Messi wasn't doing a Sudbury swing on this tour?
No, he wasn't. But you know who did come to Sudbury last week? Sidney Crosby was there.
Oh, really? Was he driving through Sudbury? Or was he actually
like,
stopping in
they
Sudbury?
They played like a pickup NHL game in Sudbury. So, you know, every now and then the stars make their way.
Did you go to see that too?
No.
I don't care. You got your fix by this weekend. Well, I'm glad you were able to make it here. Was UFC on the docket for you this weekend? Because I did, to be fair, I gave you the option of taking this one off with your trip, but you were going to watch 307. So I said, well, if you're going to do it, we might as well do this together.
I mean, I figured I was going to be watching the card tonight or last night anyway. So sure, yeah, go for it. I can't be missing a Jose Aldo fight. You don't know how many of those you're going to have left. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's, we will get into some of the more contentious decisions on this card, but the two championship fights that we had going into this, led by Alex Pereira and Khalil Roundtree Jr. How did you feel about this fight when it was announced? A lot was made about Roundtree Jr. getting this title fight. But I have to say, like, from a styles perspective, I thought a lot of people were sleeping on Khalil Roundtree Jr. going into this. And I have the audio to back it up from Thursday. I'm not saying that in hindsight either. But I was intrigued to see the fight. I can understand some concerns. I'm not going to lie, though, and say that, like, Magomed Ankalaev, boy, we would have just been hanging from the rafters if that was the title fight.
I mean, clearly Magomed Ankalaev was the most deserving fighter of a title fight. I'm not going to argue that. But I would say this was the more exciting fight on paper. And I was in the same boat as you. I thought it was, like, it wasn't just going to be an Alex Pereira knocks him out in 2 minutes sort of fight. I figured we would get a fun one. Maybe not quite the quality that we ended up getting, but nonetheless, like, I thought it was a good fight.
When did we shift with Alex Pereira, who as he is coming up in middleweight, is viewed as like, you know, devastating kickboxer who is just going to be grappled to death when he runs into the wrong opponent, to now he is like a minus 470 favorite going into this. And it doesn't seem he holds any of that. Maybe to a degree is that an Uncle Iyav might be able to expose, but it feels like the overall perception of Alex Pereira has shifted dramatically with this move to light heavyweight.
I was just about to say, I think that perception change is as a result of moving to light heavyweight, which is an extremely weak division that doesn't have a lot of strong wrestlers in it. Yeah, Magomed Ankalaev, who, you know, is actually more of a striker than a wrestler, honestly, but his wrestling is very good as well, as probably, like, wouldn't shock me if he is the favorite when that fight happens. But that aside, I mean, who is there at light heavyweight who's a strong wrestler right now? Not a lot of people are just popping into mind. So, yeah, he's going to be a massive favorite against all these guys who want to trade hands with him.
Well, this card took place at the Delta Center in their home away from home now, Salt Lake City, Utah. 17,487 is what Dana White announced, and a gate of $5 million. So this is one of the many locations where they were pumping up the local tourism. This became an ad for Salt Lake City.
I'm so glad to know that the UFC is making money and bringing all of this attraction to Salt Lake City, Utah.
Yeah, it's a great night for TKO. $5 million gate with some incentives from the local authorities and a U.S. arena record for WWE in Atlanta, all on the same night.
I mean, I'll tell you right now, I never look forward to these cards in, like, Salt Lake City or Denver when they're fighting at an odd elevation. Like, it's always, like, I always feel like you're getting a lesser version of fights or fighters who would probably perform better in other places. Maybe you can look at it and say it's kind of like a curve that you don't normally get, and there's some interest in that, seeing who holds up and who doesn't. But I always kind of look at it like, why are we even really doing fights here? What's the purpose?
You know, everyone should be C-level Kane.
Oh, yeah.
Well, our main event, Alex Pereira, Khalil Roundtree Jr., and we'll get right into things. This starts off, and Khalil Roundtree Jr., early on, he's having success with his left hand. He eats a counter right, but then it's Khalil at the end. Close round in the first, but seemed like Roundtree Jr. gets the first round. He followed that up in the second, where Pereira's using a left hook and gets cut on the bridge of the nose, and this right hand connects for Roundtree Jr., and Pereira is hurt temporarily, follows with a head kick at the end, and I have to say, after 10 minutes, I think everyone is like more engaged in this fight, because Roundtree Jr., you could argue, was up two rounds after the first 10 minutes.
I definitely thought he was. I mean, the first round was certainly close, but I thought the big blitzes from Roundtree were the big moments of the round that tipped him in his favor, and yeah, this second round was phenomenal for him, even hurting Pereira at one point.
So things begin to shift in the third round. Pereira is starting to execute a lot of low kicks, and Roundtree Jr. ducks this high kick, lands with the counter left, but then it's Pereira with a jumping knee, and he just starts tagging Roundtree, jabbing him away, hits another these knees that he hit up the middle were devastating, and this was a Pereira round, and that sets the stage for round four, which turned into a horror film, as Pereira is jabbing away, and suddenly, like, the right eye of Roundtree Jr. is about to check out of the Delta Center, because this eye, at one point, I think it's Rogan who's like, that flap, his eye is hanging, I think is how he described it, and Pereira is just following up with more right hands, more knees, and he is taking Roundtree apart. This right eye is so damaged. He's backing up, eating these big shots against the cage. But you don't see that moment that Mark Goddard has to step in and stop the fight, because Roundtree Jr. is defending, but he is just getting so damaged in the process. And to Pereira's credit, he was very patient. He was not just going for the kill here. Roundtree Jr. keeps throwing, but he is breaking down, and then it's this double body shot into an uppercut combo that puts Roundtree Jr. down. Mark Goddard has seen enough and waves us off at 4:32 of the fourth round. And my God, if you can see this photo, that I think it was Dana White that posted after, this close up of Khalil Roundtree Jr., like, it doesn't look like a human being with the damage he has taken. This right eye may never open up again. He was so destroyed in this fourth round. This is the kind of damage that you really do wonder if there's going to be effects for Khalil Roundtree Jr., but this turned into an incredible fight and ended up being the fight of the night. And I think for Khalil Roundtree Jr., if you were someone that was not really feeling him as a challenger, he comes out of this the big winner. Like, this crowd, they were all on their feet. They were chanting for him at the end. It really felt like this is going to be the defining fight of Khalil Roundtree Jr.'s career, even in defeat.
Definitely. It was an example of a fairly lowly ranked fighter who hasn't really been on a stage like this before, who made a name for himself in this UFC main event against arguably the biggest star that the sport has right now. This fourth round was an absolute massacre. I mean, he was unrecognizable just a couple minutes into it, honestly. I mean, it was a very, very good fight, very entertaining, but I mean, this fourth round was absolutely wild. I mean, it's like you said, I think coming out of this, Khalil Roundtree is the fighter who, like, a lot of people are going to have their eyes on, but at the same time, whenever a fighter of his age, a guy who's already retired before and came back from retirement, I mean, you have to wonder how many fights he has left in him after taking such damage here.
So the best post-fight video is, I think it was ESPN or whoever grabbed this, and they go to the crowd, and there's Jamahal Hill, and he's like yawning at this performance while he is surrounded by a crowd on their feet losing their minds. And yeah, Jamahal Hill, this was quite the cutaway. You know, you're looking at light heavyweight right now. Magomed Ankalaev is the obvious one. He's fighting Alexander Rakic in 3 weeks. So knowing the state of this light heavyweight division, Rakic will win that fight. Just screw up everything. But you're looking at either a lot of rematches for Pereira or, I mean, it's just the constant. Like, are you going to go down the middleweight? Are you going to go up to heavyweight? And Pereira's answer seems to be, yeah, I'll do whatever.
I think the amount of fights he's taken this year kind of backs that up. He seems to be a guy who's willing to do pretty much anything on any notice. I mean,
lingering injuries, yeah. When he accepts this. Like, it sounds like he had a rib injury going into this one. He had the broken toe before.
He's a very confident fighter. And honestly, against a lot of these guys at light heavyweight, he has good reason to be. I mean, I think he's the favorite against almost everyone in the division. Maybe Ankalaev and perhaps Jan Blachowicz would be the exception. But it's been a hell of a run. As for the Jamahal Hill yawning in the audience, did you catch Pereira's response to that in the press conference?
No, I did not see his presser yet.
They ask him about it. Say, hey, Jamahal Hill, he was yawning at your performance. And he responds, maybe he just woke up from UFC 300.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good response on the spot. So, I mean, this turned into a really great fight. And I think, yeah, Khalil Roundtree Jr. is someone that, I mean, it was a number of years ago, and he had come back from Thailand, and this guy was like a born-again striker. I was like, who is this guy that we had seen on Tough that just seemed like, you know, kind of your middle-of-the-road fighter? And he came back, and he had just shown the most incredible gains in his striking that I think that stylistically, this is what Dana White was saying, listen, it was the Dana White special. This was a badass fight. But, like, stylistically, I was really intrigued by this fight. As I was, like, looking at it this week, I'm like, this could be very, very good. And I was interested to see it, depending on your level of what constitutes a $80 pay-per-view main event.
Yeah, when you attach that price tag to it, it sounds a bit less appealing. But I'd say as far as UFC main events go, this is one of the ones that will stick in my mind by the end of the year.
If you're waving your magic wand, what would be the ideal scenario for Alex Pereira? Knowing that the guy's 37, like, this is, you know, I think he realizes, like, I don't have an infinite amount of fights left in me. But if you want to capitalize on that, what are you looking at?
I mean, just as a fight fan, I would love to see him match up against a guy like Magomed Ankalaev and see how that goes stylistically. As a promoter, hell no, that's not happening. It would be maybe a fifth fight against Israel Adesanya. Like, you want to make the most money possible? Sure. Go for it.
Let's put both of them at heavyweight. Let's try that. Israel Adesanya, bypass light heavyweight. Let's go to heavyweight.
I can't imagine the size of Alex Pereira at heavyweight.
Next up, our second championship fight of the evening, Raquel Pennington and Juliana Pena, the first defense of Pennington's championship that she won here in Toronto at UFC 297. A fight that you told me you watch at least once a month.
Yeah, I just like to remind myself of the suffering necessary to be a true MMA fan. You know, I've never watched the fight. I skipped it when it happened, and I've never gone back to see it. I think
there were a lot of Jamahal Hills in the crowd after that fight. So, I mean, this one, listen, if we're going to talk about you know, you can look at different performances. If I'm going to look at anyone that maybe was like Juliana Pena, we have not seen her fight since the summer of 2022 when she lost to Amanda Nunes. So right off the bat, I will always have my concerns when someone has not competed that long. You add the fact that this is at elevation. Like, this to me was just not the Juliana Pena that I think was somebody that I saw as a really, you know, dominant bantamweight, because this was not, I thought, one of Juliana Pena's great performances. However, the judges would not have agreed with me. So we begin this, and I mean, it's a stalemate in this first round where Pena is trying to establish her jab. Pennington does stun her with a left jab of her own, and each are just trying to time the other, picks up a bit in the final minute. And this first round would end up being the deciding factor for a lot of people. I had it for Pennington. It seems that everyone had it for Pennington except for two people. And we go to the second round, and they're clinching in the middle, knees are throwing down, and then Pennington gets up. Pena is on her back after a takedown by Pena and sneaks in some shots. Very minimal offense, but a Pena round. Third round we go, and Pena cracks her with a right hand and gets a trip takedown. And when she could get these takedowns, like, she was pretty dominant here from side control, throwing strikes this time and not just laying on top. And Pena goes to the back, gets the body triangle, and is squeezing for the choke, can't secure it. And at this point, I'm just thinking Pena is running away with this, and Pennington's title is just falling out of her grasp. So we go in. The Pennington is also getting the Mark Hominick special growing on her forehead in between rounds. So the fourth begins, and basically her corner had been criticized in the past, if you remember when she had fought Amanda Nunes, about letting her go out there. Yeah. Well, this time the corner got its big, because it's just, you need to go out there and let it all go. Just fight. And she turns it around. This was like just simple instructions, and it worked for Pennington. She stuns Pena with this high kick. And then starts going after the calf kicks, which this was Joe Rogan and Daniel Cormier. They get fixated. They're like, the leg's just there. So they have to hammer this home. Where's the leg? So when she hits this leg kick, you would have thought that she just climbed Mount Everest.
Like, it's funny to hear Daniel Cormier always talking about the leg kicks, a man who threw very few leg kicks in his illustrious career.
The leg, it's there for the taking. So Pennington continues, hits her with a right hand, and then follows up with another right and drops Pena, which John Anik on stats here notes the first knockdown in 19 fights for Raquel Pennington occurs. So history was made.
She escaped the Bilal Muhammad Club.
Yes. Drops her and then decides, you know what? I've knocked her down. She's dazed. Let's try for a guillotine. And just like no success with this at all. But a strong round regardless for Pennington. And I would say 98% of the world, I would say 99% of the audience watching this has this 2-2 going into round 5. Did you have any different?
No. I think almost everybody was on the exact same page going into round 5.
I think everyone, this was, to me, not... I know we're going to talk about round 1. I didn't think it was the most debatable round in the world. But we go to round 5. Pennington is just so much more active and fresh. Pena just seems like she is holding on here. And Pennington is using jabs. She's landing a lot with the right hand. Stuns her after a left hook. And is just walking down Pena, upping the volume. And Pena does get in some jabs at the end. And there's a counter left from Pennington. A Pennington round. I think this is a pretty straightforward mail it in. 48-47. I'm writing down my notes. I'm just putting down the graphics, Eric. And then we get Judge blah blah scores. Let's pull up the judges' cards here.
Right, so we get some familiar names here.
We have Michael Bell, 48-47, Pena. Derek Cleary, 48-47, Pennington. And Sal D'Amato.
Oh, Sal D'Amato.
Sal D'Amato. What? 48-47. And new bantamweight champion Juliana Pena. I was like, what? And take a look at this. This is not great visuals, but this is the MMA decisions. There was not one card for Juliana Pena. We had a draw, and everybody else, yours truly included, 48-47 for Pennington. I mean, this was, listen, Pennington was very classy, but even she noted, like, yeah, I thought I won that fight. And I think a lot of people believe that she won this fight. And not the only Pennington for the night that had a debatable decision, but this one much more, to me, egregious than the one on the early prelims.
I thought the first round is the perfect example of close but clear. Like,
sure.
If you look at the strike count, it is a fairly evenly struck match. It's very boring, but Pennington was clearly landing with more power, and as a result, you see everybody who watched the fight scored for her, with the exception, of course, of two of our judges, good old Saladin Motto. I was on the same page as you. I was absolutely shocked by this decision. And it was made all the better by the commentary team just going over, like, Juliana Pena's last rites before the decision was... You know how they always, like... Whenever you get to the decision, the commentators were always going over the losing fighter, like, oh, they really did their best, it was a great effort, we'll see where they go from here. It's tough to say what you're going to do after a loss like that. And no!
It's always the tell when Rogan's first question is, did you feel you did enough? Meaning, I don't think you did enough, but maybe you have a more objective view, being the fighter that we are in question here of winning this decision. And Juliana Pena not doing herself any favors to this live crowd when she is immediately put on the hot seat about fighting Kayla Harrison, who was victorious earlier in the night, and totally sidesteps the question to address Amanda Nunes, who's not even in the drug testing pool, wants to fight her. It would be the biggest fight ever, and wants to fight Amanda Nunes.
This was doubly crazy because it felt like this entire fight week was spent building up Kayla Harrison versus Juliana Pena. It felt like the thing that the UFC and the fighters themselves...
If you watched that press conference, the highlights, you would have assumed they were fighting tonight.
Everything was building towards that, and Pena here decides, no, I want Amanda Nunes, who is retired. I think the saving grace for Juliana Pena here was that the live crowd was still so upset from the previous fight that they didn't have the energy to be emotional about the decision here.
Yeah, I mean, in a just world, Raquel Pennington gets another crack at this, but, I mean, she is not the most fan-friendly of styles that I don't think Raquel Pennington is going to be knocking at the door when you have Kayla Harrison in the pipeline, when you have Amanda Nunes that apparently can snap her fingers and will have a title fight too, which she should, quite honestly. What do you think about this bantamweight division? I mean, from just a marketing standpoint, I think Juliana Pena certainly brings a lot more to the table for any of these fights with Harrison or even a Nunes, but this is still a division very much in flux, and I think they are very much looking at Kayla Harrison to be that figure that they can rejuvenate this division around.
I generally try not to think about the women's bantamweight division at all. This is a dull division right now. It wasn't that long, or at least it doesn't feel like that long ago, where women's bantamweight was very star-studded. And right now, it is not. It is the fighters who were unranked, who are at the top of the division now. And it feels less as though... that's as a result of them growing as fighters, and more just so many fighters have left. And I don't think interest is very high for this. I can't really get a gauge on Kayla Harrison's popularity or how much people want to see her fight. I mean, she's certainly a big name, it feels like, but she doesn't have the most fan-friendly style herself. I mean, for those who saw her recent fight against Larissa Bishenko, I mean...
Which PFL reminded everybody about on social media on Saturday as they got a video of.
That aura of invincibility is also kind of gone. And I don't think there's a fighter in the UFC's bantamweight division who's as good as Pashenko is. So that's definitely, if you're putting your cards on Kayla Harrison, I think there's a pretty good chance she does walk out as the champion sooner rather than later. But there's just not a lot going on there right now. And it feels like it's going to be a long time before there is.
So a two-time champion is Juliana Pena. Yeah. Last time, she did not make a defensive. Does she make one defense of this championship? A successful defense, obviously.
I'm going to say no.
Okay.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
Jose Aldo against Mario Bautista. We got, I don't know if you caught this on commentary, we got the most bizarre conspiracy about Jose Aldo, courtesy of Gilbert Burns.
Oh, I did hear this.
I have never heard about this before, but Gilbert Burns' theory is that Jose Aldo is much older than 38, because when they got involved in MMA together, Jose Aldo was 5 years older than him. Now, Gilbert Burns is like, how is he only 1 year older than me now? I mean, this, do we have a conspiracy theory here from Gilbert Burns that will require a birth certificate?
I believe Gilbert Burns 100% here, because there is some stuff about Jose Aldo's early MMA career where you look at how young he would have been when he was having those fights. It wouldn't shock me if he was actually older than that.
Could he be 43?
He totally could be 43.
Because then that's amazing if yes. He's fighting at 43 at bantamweight.
He 100% can be 43.
This is my new favorite like theory in MMA that I would love. This is like one conspiracy theory from an MMA fighter I am willing to be entertained by. Like, thank God we have like a normal conspiracy.
It's so believable. This guy has always felt 5 years older than he is, and it would make a lot of sense if that just turned out to be the case.
I just love this. I had to rewind and listen to this. I'm like, did I hear that right? So Jose Aldo comes into this an actual underdog at plus 115 against Mario Bautista, who is 8-2 in the UFC and won 6 in a row coming in here. And, you know, Mario Bautista had a clear style. He's like, forget strategy, forget game plan. I just want to entertain this crowd for 15 minutes, and I am going to give the greatest clinch work any of these Salt Lake City fans have seen. So Bautista would just pin Aldo up against the fence repeatedly. It goes without saying, Jose Aldo's takedown defense is just, it's incredible to watch this guy. Like, you are not taking him, like, when he fought Dwalishvili 2 years ago, and he struggled to get Jose Aldo, like, this is just another level of defense that this guy has, and it's remarkable to watch.
You will never see a fighter with that takedown defense again. It's unbelievable. I mean, especially as someone who doesn't come from a wrestling background, the fact that this man is impossible to take down, he just does things that other fighters don't do all the time. Like, my favorite one is the big thing about leg kicks, and you'll hear like fighters going on, but the thing about those calf kicks, they're just unblockable. So you got to take them. And he, Aldo does this thing where he pivots and he avoids calf kicks by raising his back leg and checking them. And he's just such an experimental fighter. And you see it with his takedown defense too. He's one of a kind. There's nobody like him.
So a lot of this was just Aldo trying to get off the fence, and he would try to get some strikes going, but Bautista was just the, you know, he stays big, busy going to the leg and body after 5 minutes. Into the second, Aldo is getting his jab going and cuts Bautista by the right eye and lands with a knee, defends another single leg, and they go back to clinching. They trade jabs, some big swings by Aldo. I had this even going into round three. Where were you?
Exactly the same. I thought it was pretty clear.
Three is the round to discuss here. Aldo stops yet another takedown. This is his seventh takedown he has blocked in the fight, and they get tied up, and the crowd is so restless here. Mike Beltran, the referee, steps in to separate them at one point, but Bautista goes right back to the clinch, and this crowd, they just want to see Jose Aldo get free and swing. And he manages to. He gets, like, several good shots in here. It was, how did you look at this round? I mean, by the end of it, it's like, I see both arguments here that Bautista did so little, but it felt like he totally nullified Jose Aldo. And it's really what credit you give towards his, you know, just shutting down Aldo, against the fence versus Aldo getting a handful of strikes in. And this was, it was a tough round to score. I went with Bautista, but there was certainly a divide among people who saw this round.
I feel like this is actually more of a debate about the current scoring criteria than it is about the round itself. Because, like, I'd say 5 years ago, this is a very clear win for Mario Bautista. I mean, he holds Aldo against the cage for at least 4 minutes of this last round. But under the current scoring criteria, you can argue that there's no case for him winning the round because he didn't have any effective
He was doing nothing to advance or finish the fight. I mean, Jose Aldo was utilizing offense that was offense.
I mean, so from like the eye test, I totally would have said 10-9 Bautista, but from the scoring criteria, it's a clear 10-9 for Jose Aldo. So it's just one of those odd things where it's reflective of criticism and praise for the current scoring criteria and how unsure a lot of people are how to judge a round like this. I guess I would give it 10-9 Aldo based on the criteria. But like I said, when you watch this, your mind will tell you 10-9 Bautista.
Mario Bautista does get the split decision win with 229-28. So obviously, it came down to that first round, and Jose Aldo gets the loss here. And for Bautista, I mean, this guy was just, you could barely hear him over the boos from this crowd, which, I mean, it is what it is. Is this a win that does this propel Bautista in the way that a win over Jose Aldo should?
No, I don't think it does. It was a very unimpressive performance, and that's a difficult thing to say against a fighter like Jose Aldo, who is not even at possibly 43 years of age. He's not an easy fighter to beat, but whenever you go for the stalling against the cage against a very old man at elevation, you're just not going to win a lot of fans, and it wasn't reflective of how good he is as a fighter either, because he is very good. He's better than this performance showed. With that being said, this is a smart way to fight Jose Aldo. Pressure, I mean, Aldo's lack of activity betrays him at times. And if you look in the past, you look at the Merab fight, you look at Alexander Volkanovski. I mean, these are fighters who decided to do the same thing because they didn't think standing and trading with Aldo was a good idea. So,
is there, like, we were talking about this earlier this week, like, with Jose Aldo. Like, he's ranked 10th. Bautista was ranked 11th. Like, is Jose Aldo, like, is he fighting top 10 guys from this point onwards? Or are you just putting him in fights that, like, a Dominic Cruz, for instance? Are you putting him in, like, what are the kinds of fights you're looking at for Jose Aldo at this point in his career?
It depends on what he's interested in, I'd say, because he's still a very high-level fighter. He has his limitations, of course. I don't think you'll see him fight a 5-round fight again. I think his cardio is too far gone for that at this point. But I mean, you could match him against some highly ranked opponents. And like, if you did Jose Aldo versus Sean O'Malley, Jose Aldo could win that fight. That is completely sensible. At the same time,
I would be very curious to watch that fight.
It would probably be a really good fight. And at the same time, you could put him against unranked guys or legends like Cruz. I mean, I don't know. That fight may have finally reached its expiration date, I think. Jose Aldo might be a bit too much for Dominic Cruz now, but still, in terms of name value, you can look at things like that, too. He might retire. Who knows?
You know, I looked up and down this card. I thought we were going to get, like, a plethora of retirements beyond Carlos Esparza, and we got none on this card, despite, especially as you'll talk about the early prelims later. Next up was Roman Dolidze and Kevin Holland, which was a middleweight fight. Kevin Holland fighting in his... since 2018, this guy has had 23 UFC fights going into this one. Since 2018.
Absolutely insane. And the fact that he has a very good record in those fights is remarkable as well, across two divisions.
So Dolidze early on gets the takedown. Crowd was very restless here as he's working in the guard. And Dolidze gets out. Holland is covering up as Dolidze mounts him and is landing these hammer fists, several nasty elbows. Holland survives the round, but in this scramble from the guard, he ends up messing up his rib, whether he popped it, whether it was, whatever he did to his rib. He goes to his corner and he's just telling his corner, like, my rib is screwed up. And his coach is like, can you continue? And Daniel Cormier's like, you can't let the fighter make that choice. You got to make it for them. And his coach, Bob Perez, ends up stating the fight is off. They wave it off after the first round. And props to Roman Dolidze. He does the I've won the championship celebration. He puts his arms up. He's like, yes, I have conquered Kevin Holland. And listen, he did the damage here. He gets the victory. But yeah, kind of a unsatisfying ending to this fight prematurely. But I mean... the rib was gone, and that was that.
Certainly an unsatisfying ending, but it was an injury that Dolidze caused, so a legitimate win. And, I mean, I favored him going into this one. From the way the fight was playing out, it looked like it was probably going to be a good night for him regardless. Yeah, I mean, it's a fight. Yeah. Not too much to say.
Yeah, Kevin Holland will be back, I'm sure, this year.
I think after his fight, Dolidze calls out, like, Robert Whittaker and Khamzat Chimaev, and then says he wants the fight in December. And let me tell you, if you think that Khamzat Chimaev, a man who fights once every 3 years, is doing a one-month turnaround...
Now, okay. He said December. He never, never designated a year, okay?
Yeah, fair enough.
This might be a long-term plan. And the pay-per-view opened up with... two-time Olympic gold medalist Kayla Harrison taking on Ketlin Vieira. First of all, just your thought going into this about Kayla Harrison getting after the Holly Holm fight, were you thinking that she would get fast-tracked beyond that? The fact that they put her against Ketlin Vieira, what did that... did you think that that was necessary to kind of get a gauge of things for Kayla.
I didn't think it was necessary. I did think they were likely to go right into the title fight for Harrison coming off that win. But at the same time, I didn't think it was a big risk doing this fight either. I mean, Harrison was a gigantic favorite, and she was a gigantic favorite for a reason. The fight itself, rather dull. But with that being said, it was a decent performance. Caitlin Vieira is a good fighter. It wasn't going to be necessarily a super dominant quick finish for Harrison, but I think she did enough to showcase why she is thought of so highly.
Kayla Harrison comes into this 17-1 record that Larissa Pacheco gets to always be the one in 17-1.
She's also two in that 17, so.
That's true. That's true. You don't get to, you go by the wins and the losses. So they have a clinch battle in the first. Harrison gets a big takedown, goes to half guard, mounts her, and lands an elbow, as Joe Rogan classifies this as woman handling her after correcting himself. And then we go into the second. Harrison ties her against the cage, and Harrison does take an elbow strike, and this hematoma forms over her eye from this elbow. Closer round in the second, I still gave the first two to Harrison. And then the third, another takedown. Pretty aggressive with ground and pound, working to half guard, then to mount. It was just a Kayla Harrison performance here that stood out. I had all three rounds for Kayla Harrison. One judge gave a round to Vieta, but a clear, decisive win for Kayla Harrison.
I have the same scorecard as you. You could give the second round to Vieira, but I don't think there's any argument for taking the first or the third.
And I think after that, you have to just wonder... is Kayla Harrison now going to have to wait for Amanda Nunes to come out of retirement, challenge for the championship, and then she'll get her title fight in 18 months?
Well, now that USADA is out of the way, I mean, Amanda Nunes could fight again in 2 weeks probably, so maybe it won't be a big turnaround. But as far as I know, Amanda Nunes is happily retired, and I do imagine that Kayla Harrison will be next in line.
All right, let's go into the undercard. What I did get to see was Joaquin Buckley and Stephen Thompson, where, you know, Buckley, he has been unbeaten since moving to welterweight. And I mean, he is just brings with him a ton of power here, but this was a very big step up for him against Stephen Thompson, who even at 41, I mean, technically this guy is still like a real quality, welterweight. I felt they split the first two rounds. You had Buckley with this big double leg off the fence at the beginning and then got a later takedown in the round. In the second, it's Buckley shooting against the fence, and Thompson drills him with these elbows to the side of the head, going all Johnny Hendricks here on George St. Pierre. And then Buckley forces a takedown despite some strong defense. Better round for Thompson. And in between rounds, Stephen Thompson's dad, Ray, "We're not here to survive. We're here to win." That's what you want to hear from Pops. And we go into the third, and well, Thompson did not survive nor win, because he was blasted with this right hand from hell that Buckley, this was like a power up by in a video game, as he blasted Thompson against the fence. He had nowhere to move to absorb this shot, and Thompson just goes down, and like he was out. 2:17 of the third round, winner by knockout, Joaquin Buckley, who realizes, even at 5-0 at welterweight, I still need another fight. So Shavkat and Bilal, they can do their thing. I want to fight you, Usman, so maybe I can put my 5-0 record against what he called your 3-0 record in losses, is how he qualified it. But calling out Usman after this, which Daniel Cormier, who had been critical of his callouts in the past, said that was a good callout. So Joaquin Buckley, big win for him when you consider the names that have beaten Stephen Thompson.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're getting to a point in Thompson's career where the losses are starting to pile up a bit. You can see weaknesses in his game that weren't previously there. But one thing that's always been a weakness for Stephen Thompson is his tendency to retreat in a straight line towards the cage. It's something he's been caught with many times over the years, and it was the case yet again here from Buckley. Really strong finish for him. Usman call out, it's a good call out. It doesn't seem outside the realm of possibility. But I don't know what Kamaru Usman's future is at this point. He must be 40 years old or approaching that at this point. His knees are non-existent. He has those Hiroshi Tanahashi knees. Like, they're in rough shape. He doesn't even wrestle anymore. But, you know, he's one of the greatest fighters of all time. He's a good call-out, I'd say, if you're a guy like Joaquin Buckley, if you want to jump right into title contention.
And then... Eric is going to take us through these undercard fights, starting off with Yasmin Lucindo and Marina Rodriguez at 115 pounds.
Yeah, this was a bit of an uneventful one. Rodriguez dropped Lucindo early, which was the deciding factor in what was otherwise a fairly close round. But as the fight progressed, Rodriguez was probably the better striker, but Lucindo was just coming on stronger with her shots, and I thought the last two rounds were fairly clear for Lucindo. I mean, you could argue Rodriguez took them, but it was a split decision. There was no shortage of those on this card, but I scored it for Lucindo. Going earlier into the night, we have Austin Hubbard and Alex Hernandez. Another dull first round. These are pretty much what my notes look like for like five fights on these prelims. A dull round, slight edge to this fighter, maybe 10-9 Hernandez. With that being said, once we go a bit further into the fight, it starts to pick up. Hernandez starts to advance, and I thought he was doing better work as the fight progresses here. I scored the first two rounds for Hernandez before Hubbard really comes alive in that third round. He's like landing these front kicks over and over again, and they are clearly hurting him. But in the end, we do go to the decision here. I had it for 29-28 for Hernandez. What was the actual decision here? I don't remember.
229-28 for Hernandez, and a split decision favorite. A 30-27 for Hubbard.
Yes, yes, of course.
There were four splits on this card, remarkably.
Here's the main event, though. This is the only fight I really want to talk about on these prelims, and it is Cesar Almeida versus Ihor Potiera. I mean, this was one of the worst refereed fights that you will ever see in MMA, okay?
Please tell us.
Boring first round. Let's not even talk about it. We go into round two. Potiera was fouled four times in the span of 1 minute, and they were all caught.
In a minute?
Yeah, in about a minute, okay? This guy gets kicked low, then he gets poked in the eye, then he gets poked in the eye, and he gets poked in the eye again.
So this is Potiera that's getting fouled.
Yeah, Potiera is getting fouled, and every time the fight does get stopped, these aren't uncalled fouls, but there is basically no warning. There is no way. I might take a point. There is nothing. And he goes back into the fight, and Almeida is beating on him at this point, taking him down. He's landing strong ground and pound. Like, this was a good round for Almeida, but four uncalled fouls. And this is where we go into round three. And this is where, I mean, the commentary team.
I need to go back and watch this.
You
one.
Need to watch
this.
This
is the fight I'm going to catch.
The commentary team is having a field day with the ref at this point. Because guess what? We get a fifth eye poke.
Oh, Jesus.
Once again, practically no warning at all. Mike Belchon is apparently standing outside the cage with, like, doing a face palm. Just,
who was the referee?
I don't have his name off the top of my head. It wasn't a regular. He did not call another fight on this card. And we get to the big one. So Potiera finally is able to mount find some success by backing Almeida into the cage. And maybe 5 seconds after he brings him into the clinch, they get separated. So he goes back to it. He does it again. Maybe 5 seconds, they get separated. And for a third time, he backs him into the cage, and after maybe 5 to 10 seconds, the fighters get separated.
This was not a household name of MMA referees. David Seljestad.
Sure. He's probably a name you'll never hear again after tonight. I mean, one of the worst ref fights I've ever seen. I'm not too hard on referees, generally. It's a very tough job. But this was a very bad performance.
Throw this guy's name onto Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite the report card.
It was a very rough name for him. 30-27 Almeida, who won every round with his five uncalled fouls. This is one where, yeah, I would suggest taking 15 minutes to go back and watch this one. Just the last two rounds, really, but an absolutely remarkable, remarkable performance from when referee Dan here.
On the early prelims, I got to see most of these fights. I didn't get to see the Carlos Esparza Tisha Pennington fight, but Ovince St. Preux took on Ryan Spann, 41-year-old OSP. Ryan Spann, I mean, just at another level here than OSP in 2024. OSP's first kick of the entire fight lands low. They restart, Spann is fine, and just connects with a right, then stuns OSP, and then grabs hold of the neck, powers him to the ground, and the guillotine ends things as OSP taps out at a minute 35 of round number one as, Ryan Spann gets his latest win at light heavyweight after losing three in a row. So he needed to turn things around here.
Pretty much exactly what you'd expect from this fight. I mean, I don't know if Ovince St. Preux should be fighting anymore. Of all of the names that we talked about retiring on this card, all of these old men who are possibly older than they claim to be in the case of one particular fighter, but Ovince St. Preux is just rough loss after rough loss at this point.
Carlos Esparza had a retirement fight against Tisha Pennington. This was rare. Tisha went the distance in this fight.
First time for everything.
One stoppage win in her her career in the UFC. And she gets the win here, 30-27, 29-28, 29-28. And afterwards, they did give a video on Carla Esparza, who had her child in the octagon with her, a two-time strawweight champion. Did you score this one for Pennington?
I scored it for Carla Esparza. So did the people in attendance, who were very, very upset about this decision.
Yes. And Tisha was the first one that just got rained down on Bubas here.
If there's a second thing to go out of your way to watch, it is the crowd just showering Tisha in booze as she dedicates her fight to breast cancer awareness.
Oh, dude, that was so gross, where she's like giving this heartfelt speech about breast cancer awareness, and the crowd is booing this. I was like, oh, they could not come on. This crowd just sounded like
peak horrific. MMA. Peak MMA.
Totally, totally. And then the opener, Court McGee and Tim Means, with McGee fighting here in Utah, ends in the first round. McGee got this nice combination off, took him down, had one hook in, battled to get both in, and with Court's back against the cage, got the neck crank and submitted him at 3:19 of the first round.
Court McGee's first finish in 14 years, and he was looking... He's looking pretty good physically.
He's going on a run.
I think this new deal with the lack of USADA might suit Court McGee well. He was looking a bit jacked.
The average age of these early prelims, 37.3, which is brought down significantly by Ryan Spann's involvement on this card. But yeah, I really thought we might get a handful of retirements on this show. The only official one, Carla Esparza. And that was UFC 307. I guess this card held up better than our camera did, but nonetheless, you're hearing us in crystal clear audio, we hope. As always, UFC 307, quite the trip.
Yeah, I'd say so. All in all, I'd say this was a decent card. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people were left unsatisfied by some of the injuries and controversial scorecards on the main card, but in terms of star power, you had a decent amount of names here, and I thought the main event was very good.
Coming up next weekend, it's back to the stomping grounds of the Apex, as Brandon Royval takes on Tetsura Taira, as Brad Tavares will take on Park Jun-yong in the top fights at the Apex. That sounds like an Apex card.
So it's abysmal.
The following weekend, another doozy for the Apex. If you're taking in Contender Series fights, plus you get this. Anthony Hernandez against Michel Pereira, which they brought up at the press conference that Hernandez witnessed a shooting on Saturday and then had to alert authorities as they caught the shooter. This was brought up to Dana White, who just was like, I don't know how to respond to that. Rob Font against Kyler Phillips is the other fight that's coming up October 19th. And then UFC 308, tentatively, I would like to do this card. It's the Ilya Topuria, Max Holloway fight, which is one of the better fights we have on the calendar for the remainder of this year. Robert Whittaker is scheduled to fight Khamzat Chimaev. Will that fight take place on October 26th?
I can already see Kelvin Gastelum's name being called as he's brought in to replace Khamzat Chimaev on 7 days' notice.
And then Lerone Murphy against Dan Ige, Magomed Ankalaev against Alexander Rakic, which could upset plans at 205 pounds. And Shara Magomedov against Armin Petrosian rounds out the main card. Man, RDA is on the undercard against Jeff Neal. Saeed Nurmagomedov against Daniel Santos. The mileage may vary once we get into the prelims here. But a good main card with two really great top fights on this card. And one of the better main events, I think, this year with Topuria and Holloway. Do you have any impressions of that fight? Is this just Topuria this is his time, because Max Holloway, this could be his last chance at a championship, and he's coming off that incredible stoppage against Gaethje.
I do think this is probably Topuria's toughest test at featherweight, because if there is a single fighter that he can't just blast through, you would assume it'd be Max Holloway, who's been dropped a grand total of once in his entire career. I mean, he has an iron chin, and he's against this guy who's been able to put almost everybody out. So it's a very unstoppable force beats immovable object. I'm really looking forward to that fight, honestly.
So really good card, and it's an afternoon show because it's coming from Abu Dhabi on October 26th. But there you go. That's our coverage of UFC 307, a live in-studio appearance by Eric Marcotte, which you can rewind the video for confirmation. He was here, and
it was all AI. We can drop the act now.
That's it. We got to just turn the off button on. That's it for us, but thanks everyone for joining us. We'll be back after UFC 308 in a couple of weeks, pending Eric's work schedule, which is always, we've got to navigate. The man is busier than Alex Pereira as a light heavyweight champion. But thanks to everyone for tuning in. We are going to be back on Monday night, myself and Wei Ting, with Rewind of Raw. We also have a review of Bad Blood up from last night that Eric will have to go back and watch. There was more blood on that card than there was on this UFC card.
Khalil Roundtree might disagree.
You're right. You know what? Khalil Roundtree would have an argument to that. But that's it for us. Thanks for tuning in.